From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, hospitals in Michigan's Thumb feel the toll of a massive COVID-19 surge.
Earlier this week, three counties in the Thumb had positivity rates over 30%.
A reporter fills us in on how doctors and nurses are coping. Then, someone who actually met her pandemic fitness goals.
I had to get really creative, and I've come up with some different challenges. Testing the waters for the ultra marathoning was the latest thing on the schedule.
We'll talk with the Michigan runner who just broke the world record for fastest 50K. And still looking for that vaccine appointment? Have you considered Ohio?
Certainly, if there's supply available, we're going to get it into the arms of people so that it's not wasted and that it produces benefit.
Why some Michiganders are headed across the border for their shots. Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On today's show, we're going to visit a COVID vaccination clinic in the Toledo area that's been hosting a healthy share of Michiganders.
We were having difficulty finding what we needed in our local area, so we easily found an appointment here, and we were able to schedule within just a few days' time to come down and get the vaccine.
That's coming up later in the hour, but first, counties in Southeast Michigan's Eastern Shore still rank among the hottest spots in the state for COVID infection rates. Hospitals are reporting near capacity conditions. It's not great anywhere in Michigan right now, but the Thumb is in serious trouble. Michigan Radio's Caroline Yanis has been reporting on these counties, and she joins me now. Hi, Caroline.
Hey, April.
So what are conditions like in the Thumb as you've seen them?
Well, things aren't great in the Thumb. If we look at the 7-day average of test positivity rates, which is basically however many people get tested, what percent of those tests come back positive. If we look at those, earlier this week, three counties in the Thumb had positivity rates over 30%, which means that a good chunk of these communities who are getting tested are testing positive for COVID. Those are Tuscola, Sanilac, and Huron all had positivity rates of over 30%. And that kind of makes a lot of medical professionals nervous because there are people who aren't getting tested. So there's a good chance that there's even more people who have COVID out in the community who don't even know they have it and they could be spreading it around.
What have the consequences been like for hospitals in St. Clair and Sanilac and some of the nearby counties?
Yeah, they're having a bit of a rough go of it at the moment. So we're kind of seeing a lot of hospitals that are near bed occupancy. And a lot of these healthcare systems, because these are more rural areas, they're relying on other hospitals in the area to be able to kind of help them out. They're very integrated. Can you take this patient? We don't have the resources to care for them. And so that's putting a strain on that system, too. At McKenzie Hospital in Sanilac County, they actually don't have an ICU or a COVID wing. So anytime someone comes in and tests positive for COVID and needs to be hospitalized, they have to transport that patient to another hospital. Let's hear from Dr. Mark Hamed, who works at McKenzie Hospital. He says that they've had a really tough time trying to get these patients into beds.
I can tell you right now, all of our regional hospitals, Port Huron, Saginaw, Flint, even many in the Metro Detroit area were not accepting because they were kind of at capacity themselves. So we've had to call, God, I think 14 or 15 hospitals are my last shift to get one to accept, and it was a case-by-case basis.
What do public health officials say are driving these incredibly high numbers right now?
It's kind of a perfect storm, is what a lot of people have said. Right now, we're having a little bit of warmer weather in Michigan. We've had a kind of a rough winter, and people, they want to be outside. They want to see people more often. And that's relevant because, you know, people ask, well, Florida and Texas are completely open. Why aren't we seeing these kinds of numbers there? Well, Florida and Texas are warm all year round. Those people aren't coming out of a Michigan winter, for one thing. We also are seeing looser restrictions. We don't have these kinds of stay-at-home orders, these things like that anymore. And so people are out and about. It's also a younger population. So it's people in their 20s to their 50s. And these people weren't prioritized in the first round of vaccinations. So fewer of them are vaccinated. That's a good thing because we know that that vaccine for that older population is working. But now we have this unvaccinated population who are out spreading it around. And part of that is also the B.1.1.7 variant, the UK variant, which is kind of the big strain here in Michigan at the moment, and it is more contagious. And so when you have this more contagious virus and this perfect storm of people who are out and about again after a long time of staying home, you kind of get these much higher rates and this sort of greater this transmission.
Caroline, can we get back for just a minute to the medical end of things? We're in a very different place right now in terms of medical expertise than we were early on in the pandemic. Are hospitals in the thumb able to treat the patients that they do have any more effectively than they were able to last year?
Yeah, that's one thing that a lot of healthcare workers say has gotten a little easier, which is great. And so last spring, one of the big concerns is, oh my God, do we have enough ventilators? This is a really severe respiratory illness. One of the interesting things that the doctors have figured out is that if someone comes into the hospital and they need to be intubated, they found that you can stabilize the patient if you pump them with high flow oxygen, 30 to 40 liters a minute. That stabilizes them and keeps them alive and off a ventilator. So things like that we've learned have been really helping doctors. And there's one thing that actually the state has announced that they want to expand recently, and that's monoclonal antibody therapy. And at McLaren Port Huron, Dr. John Brooks, who's the medical director there, he says they've had a lot of success with monoclonal antibody therapy, and I'll let him talk about that here.
So to get monoclonal antibody, they have to have COVID, and they have to have risk factors, and they have to seek care. And those people, we have had an excellent response, and very, very few of them have had to come back for any further medical care.
And they've been able to treat 400 patients, he says, they've been able to do monoclonal antibody therapy with.
All throughout this pandemic, public health officials have been warning that our smaller hospitals, our rural hospitals, are at risk during the surges because they have less of an infrastructure for dealing with acute cases. Would you say that's been the case in the thumb?
I would say yes to a certain extent. The one thing is, because the thumb didn't really get as hard in that first spring surge of 2020, when we kind of saw Southeast Michigan, the city of Detroit, as being the sort of hotspot, they didn't get as hard during that surge. And so they were able to look at what other health systems were doing, and they were able to prepare a little bit, which has been really helpful when dealing with this surge. So, you know, you have these hospitals that were able to plan ahead a little bit and be like, okay, so maybe we're not used to caring for these patients. We should figure out these resources now. At McKenzie Hospital, which I mentioned earlier, they transport patients out, but they've kind of thought to themselves, okay, well, we're getting to the worst case scenario. So they've set up these negative pressure rooms, and they are actually able to start inpatient treatment that they normally wouldn't do there, that they would normally have the other hospital do, like giving a patient remdesivir, for example. And so having that time to prepare has been a huge help for these hospitals, but they are still feeling the strain. Even being prepared doesn't really prepare you for just this surge of cases and the level of stress that comes with treating all these people.
I believe it. We've been hearing some really scary stories from nurses and others, both in Southeast Michigan's metro areas and on the west side, of people just being completely burned out from well over a year of this. Were you hearing anything about what this has been like for hospital staff in the region?
Yeah, it's been tough. And the thing about the thumb, too, is that these doctors are telling me it's a very close-knit community. So a lot of times people are treating their neighbors, their family members, their friends, and it takes a real emotional toll on them. It's just so much more work than anyone was really prepared to have to do. And we certainly didn't think we'd be here a year later. At McLaren Port Huron, nurses have kind of restructured their whole staffing system. They're moving patients from floor to floor just to try and free up space, free up beds. And in Sanilac County, too, it's not just the hospital staff, but also EMS workers, people who are responding to emergency calls. They're also really feeling the strain as hospitalizations increase, and they try and transport people to these medical centers that can give them the proper level of care that they need.
You know, we had a really interesting conversation this week with a restaurant owner in the Thumb, and he said for a lot of folks in his area, mask wearing just isn't a thing. There's still some hesitation around getting vaccinated. What did you hear from people in the hospital system? What are they seeing?
They're definitely seeing some of that, I would say for sure. I think the biggest concern is misinformation going around about vaccines. They're worried that these people in these communities aren't getting the right information. And they want people to know that, yes, there are risks, as there are with any vaccine, but the vaccine is largely safe and it's really effective. And that's what we've been seeing throughout this pandemic. So, and something that they want to emphasize too is personal responsibility. You know, this is not just you, this is your neighbors who are getting sick. It's your family, it's your friends. And so I think that's the message that they're really trying to emphasize, that when you're doing these measures, getting vaccinated, wearing a mask, it's not just for you, it's for your community.
These numbers in the Thumb have been pretty bad for a couple of weeks now. Did the folks you spoke with notice any shift in attitude among people in the region about maybe precautions that they might take?
Yeah, actually, they have seen kind of a shift in behavior, and that's really encouraging. Dr. Mark Hamed told me, he says he thinks the Thumb's kind of getting a bad rap.
So one thing about the Thumb is that they're a very caring community. They all care about their neighbors, their relatives, who, you know, I think the motivating factor has been they're seeing people who they know and love get very sick. And that's really changing behaviors. It really is. The people are masking up. They're being proactive. They're coming to ER for a test. Even though they don't feel bad, they want to get tested now.
And so that's been, I think, a very encouraging shift in behavior for a lot of these healthcare workers to see. And especially as these cases increase, more people getting tested. Like I said earlier, there's people who are infected who don't even know it. And so this kind of proactive attitude is going to be really important for these communities in the Thumb as we try and get out of this surge.
Michigan Radio's Carolyn Yanis. You can read her story about COVID in the Thumb online right now at michiganradio.org. Caroline, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. You've heard, of course, of marathons, a run of 26.2 miles. An ultra marathon is anything longer than that. Michigan's Des Linden ran her first ultramarathon this week. She hadn't done it before, so this 2018 Boston Marathon winner thought, you know, what the heck? And how was her time? She just broke the world record for 50K runs. Actually, more like annihilated it by more than a 7-minute margin, averaging 5 minutes, 47 seconds per mile. A person's got to have goals during the pandemic, right? Joining us today is runner Des Linden. Des, it's great to hear your voice. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me on.
So many events got canceled over the past 14 months. What exactly happens to your body and your training? And I mean your mental training, too, when you go through a dry spell like that.
Yeah, that's been the big question. It's like, how do you stay motivated during this time? There are no races. Events are canceled. And honestly, I wasn't. That's the truth. It's like, that's the thing that gets me excited is big stages, big crowds. Big events. And so I had to get really creative and I've come up with some different challenges and testing the waters for the ultra marathoning was the latest thing on the schedule.
What was it like to race again this week?
It was so fun. I mean, it was a small scale thing. We made sure it was COVID safe, really small number of people out there and secluded area. So it was different in no crowds, not a lot of excitement around the race, but on the course, it was business as usual. And it turns out running is still right foot, left foot, repeat. So that's good. It hasn't changed. And it was fun to get a little taste of it again, that nervous energy at the start and then people, you know, chasing down big dreams. And that was all there on a small scale. And it seems we all felt optimistic afterwards, like we're getting closer.
Did the smaller crowds have any effect on your mood throughout the race?
It was very lonely. You're used to late in the race when you're suffering. There's all the people watching, all the people cheering. And You don't want to break down in front of them, and you want to give them something to be excited about. And all that was missing. So it was a very internal you versus you battle, which happens anyhow, but it was just kind of on a heightened scale. But I think there was sort of this social media community that was following along. And so I just tried to picture them out there and, you know, give them something to be excited about and to tweet about, I suppose.
It's a little different picturing people staring at their phones following your times rather than watching along the course or in a televised setting, I'm sure. Well, what can you tell us about how your race strategy compared for this longer event compared with how you've approached marathon running?
It was pretty similar. I think, you know, you get to these longer events and it's all about having a lot of patience. But it's also stepping into the unknown. I think when you step up to the marathon, it's like, how's my body going to respond that last, you know, 6 miles or so? And it was staying patient into those miles and then going, well, after 26 miles, what's going to happen? So it's sort of extending that patience out and then, you know, dialing the pace back just a little bit. So it was similar in terms of, you know, the mental makeup and just totally different in terms of the fear of the distance, because you just don't know how you're going to respond. So it was a very fun challenge. And fortunately, I managed it pretty well.
Was there a point in your training when you did realize that you could attack the pacing of it more or less like you have marathons?
Yeah, we kind of amped up my long runs a good amount. And I did a marathon in a workout and was running some really great splits and, you know, covered the 26-mile distance and added on the 0.2 because you have to. And I felt strong. So that was really encouraging. And so it allowed me to take that confidence to the race. And I had initially targeted 5:50s, and I talked to my coach beforehand. He's like, that's not going to be fast enough. You need to be around 5:45. Turns out we split the difference.
Can you explain sort of how you keep track in your head when you're in the middle of a race?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's all the mile markers out there. And so you're just focusing on one segment at a time, and it's get through this mile right on pace. And it was a great course setup. It was 6.5 miles out. So you have, you know, a way to break that down. Then you turn around, you come back 6.5 miles. And we did that a handful of times. So it's instead of looking down the road and thinking about how far you have to go, it's staying very present and going like, what do I need to do in this mile, you know, this minute, this moment? And it keeps you from getting too far ahead of yourself, because that can be daunting and change the mood real quickly.
I've seen the terrain outside of Eugene, Oregon, near Cottage Grove, where you were running, and it's really nice country. Did that help at all?
It was stunning. We went out and did a little shakeout the day before, and so beautiful. And it felt like being at like running camp when you're in high school and you actually have to, you know, the tents, and you're not showering, you're just jumping in the lake for a week. And it was super inspiring. But it was also like, you could easily just tune out and be like, oh, I'm on a nice leisurely run out here in the middle of Oregon in this beautiful place. So I was kind of balancing those two things.
Nice leisurely 31 plus mile run. Absolutely. Des, you're such a decorated distance runner. Obviously, longer events have a lot of appeal for you. But now we know the longer the distance, the better. What is it about really long events that's keeping you mentally engaged?
It's just the challenge of it right now. I feel like I've done so much in the marathon, and I feel very satisfied with my career. I've been on two Olympic teams, one Boston. Those were the things that kept me motivated. And so now it's finding that new challenge and testing myself in new ways. And, you know, I'm always trying to learn a little bit more about myself. And these distances are certainly giving me some information and allowing me to get creative and curious about how to attack them.
You know, a lot of people are talking about what your time this week did for visibility in the ultra marathon space. What do you think it will take beyond spectacular times to get more people interested in ultra marathons as spectators?
That's a good question. I think it's a very niche sport, but the communities are really incredible, great people. And maybe it's just sharing more often and really giving a glimpse into that process that goes into preparation and, you know, kind of carrying people along into the buildup. But we're seeing it, you know, in a lot of different events, these sort of off-road, less, I don't want to call it less serious, but like less focused community. They get a great following because they're fun and the atmosphere around it is just different. Like gravel cycling has become huge recently. And I kind of look at the trail ultra scene, like the gravel of running. So
it's
I think
gritty.
It's doing what we're doing. Yeah, it really is. And just storytelling and talking about it. And, you know, people will find their way to these events.
Ultra marathoners, the hardworking truck drivers of the running world.
It kind of sounds like it. Yeah, definitely. You hear blue collar thrown around a lot in running. So maybe that's the spot.
We're in this time where there are more marathoners moving into the ultra marathon space, doing 50-mile races, doing 100-mile races. I don't want to go too far with this, but it does feel like some of our historic boundaries of strength and endurance are, if not falling away exactly, maybe going through some kind of substantial change. I saw a tweet from you that 50K is the new marathon. First of all, it just made me want to go lie down. And second of all, I wonder if you think that there is a limit either for you personally or for how far ultra runners can go.
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I feel like that's kind of what I'm in the middle of exploring. Yeah, it's fascinating. And I think people are always coming up with new challenges and we all want to test ourselves and see where our limits are and where our boundaries are. At a certain point, it'll have to get creative because they have, you know, the 24-hour mark. I want to say they have a 48-hour mark, the 100-milers. But yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely new challenges out there and ways to test ourselves. So it's fun to be in a time where it's appreciated and celebrated to kind of come up with new ideas and new tests for us.
Obviously, you're an alternate for the U.S. Olympic Games this summer. Do you have a plan for the fall beyond that?
I do. It's in the vault for now, but to be announced soon. Yeah, I will definitely go back to some major marathons. So that will be the fall. And, you know, hopefully we'll see what happens with Tokyo, just being ready for that and then being able to pivot and shift to a standard big city marathon in the fall is kind of the game plan.
Well, that's good news because it means hopefully we'll be able to see you, more of us will be able to see you run with the amped up coverage that we get for some of the big city marathons. The average runner of any stripe, really, just even people who go out for, you know, fitness a couple times a week, the average runner has a real relationship with distance, so to speak. Is there anything that you tell people when they ask you about just the mental energy that when they're trying to extend what they're doing?
I think it's a patience thing. I mean, I think that's so much of what distance running is about. And anytime we're testing ourselves and trying to extend or go faster or whatever it may be, we're in like a culture of instant gratification, and that's not the case with distance running. So it's just a friendly reminder to stay patient, keep putting in the work, keep slowly chipping away at it, and you'll see results eventually, but don't expect them tomorrow in distance running.
As somebody who's a competitive distance runner, that relationship between patience and the competitive spark are such an interesting balance with you. Which one do you think is primary?
Probably the competitive side. And I think I almost view patience as a competitive advantage. It's knowing when to strike and understanding the timing of things and periodization of training. It is a balance, but if you're really competitive, you see the value in being patient and you apply it to the competitive side.
Congratulations on such an amazing time.
Thank you so much.
Des Linden just broke the women's world record for a 50,000 meter run. Her next announced event is the Summer Olympics in Tokyo, where she'll be an alternate for the U.S. team. It was just over a year ago that students at Lapeer's Center for the Arts, a little bit east of Flint, were about to take the stage at the town's 100-year-old Pix Theater. They were going to debut a play they'd been working on for months. In this week's installment of Creating Connection, a series of personal stories demonstrating the impact of Michigan's arts and culture organizations, we're going to hear how students and staff responded and ultimately came to take their curtain calls via Zoom.
My name is Mary Beth Burns, and I teach theater at the Pix Theater in Lapeer, Michigan. Before COVID, the Pix was producing one children's show per year.
My name is Jessica Cummings. I am 17 years old, and I started participating in the Pix Theater 2 years ago.
The kids broke it to us. When that happened, we did scramble.
And then that's when I talked to Mary Beth and said, hey, you know we can do virtual programs too, right? And then next thing we know,
we had a weekly virtual radio mystery show that aired live every Friday night at 7 with a focus on the golden age of radio.
This is Gavin Wandry, bringing you the first in our series of Stories of the Unusual. Lights out, everybody.
I just started going through the archives and picking out scripts that are in the public domain.
You're alone, me and you, and the blood in your veins.
What?
Well, he lived. I couldn't touch him. But now he's dead.
What do you want of me? What do you want?
In addition to that, I worked with some students to create a radio show.
5 years ago, in a small town located in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, many children disappeared. The police have had no luck in finding anyone. Many residents took it upon themselves to look for these children, me included. What I came to realize is that there are many things we are unable to understand.
Everybody seemed enthusiastic. We had good attendance.
I am Leah Hoke and I am 13 years old. I started going to the Lapeer Pix Art Theater last year. There was really nothing to do around the house and I decided, I guess we can go do plays online because I can't go out of the house and do them.
Many of them live in rural areas, and it would be hard to get to places anyway. This is just another excellent way of leveling the playing field, provided they have Wi-Fi.
It's more happy things to do other than just sitting in your bed, doing homework, and when you're done, just watching TV.
We extended programming into the fall.
Good evening and welcome to the Center for the Arts Youth Theater Program presentation of Virtual Family.
It's a family and they're called the Virtuals.
Virtual Family was an entire play you can make at home. No set, no costumes. Audience members would also be able to virtually watch.
The script already has them in separate rooms. So this was something they could do from their own home.
My name is Alex.
Alex is kind of like I was on Alexa, spelled A-A-L-I-X.
That stands for Artificial Assistant and Life Instructor Extraordinaire.
The virtuals have an artificial life intelligence bot, Alex, who helps mom in the kitchen.
Alex, do you mind helping me, please?
I wanted to be the mom because she's a little more sassy.
Find me a recipe for turkey meatballs, please.
I'd be glad to help. Turkey is a transcontinental country located mostly on the Anatolian Peninsula with a small portion on the Balkan Peninsula.
So my internet is not good because we live in the middle of the woods. It cuts out. So you would wait and then after like 3 seconds, you would speak again.
It definitely was hard at first understanding the lags and understanding the glitches.
Alex, please find me a recipe for the food meatballs.
Meatballs is a 1979 summer camp comedy featuring a young Bill Murray as Tripper.
There were even times when Alex would get the mother sidetracked.
Oh, but I do love a young Bill Murray. I wonder if that's on Netflix or Amazon. Oh, wait. Mom, pay attention. Alex, you got the turkey part right and the meat part right, but I want it in a bowl form, not loaf. I mean, you got 2 out of 3.
Now playing 2 out of 3 ain't bad. Bye, meatloaf.
Alex, stop and listen to me. Don't get me wrong. That is a great song, but I'm not in the mood for meatloaf right now. I want meatballs, Alex.
By the performance, we knew what to do in order to help each other with the cues.
Let me make sure I heard you correctly. Would you like a recipe for turkey meatballs?
Yes, Alex, please.
Here's a recipe from Yummy in My Tummy, that food. Mix 2 pounds of ground turkey.
And everything was forgiven as soon as she gave her the recipe.
And bake for 20 minutes at 375 degrees.
Wow. I don't know what I would do without you.
I'm afraid I do not understand your request. Please, let me try again.
Oh, Alex.
It was kind of stressful, but I'm pretty proud of how I dealt with it. It did help me get through being bored.
Theater to us is the happiest place to be. It's our escape to join these productions and plays. We do want to go back physically as soon as we can.
Oh, I would want to go back so bad because when I'm on the stage and I look directly at the audience, I feel like, wow, there's a lot of people and I have to like meet the play standards.
I miss it so much. I love seeing people's interactions. I do love seeing all my friends. Theater physically, honestly, it's a different experience than anyone can see online.
It's going to be great. There will be tears.
Our series, Creating Connections, was produced by Elizabeth Meister and Dan Collison at Long Haul Productions and funded by the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. Even though vaccinations are becoming more and more widely available by the day, scheduling that dose can be a daunting task. Depending on where you live, it might be easier to cross a state line than to get one in Michigan. Some people in Southeast Michigan have had luck going down to Toledo for vaccines. Stateside producer Mercedes Mejia visited a Lucas County, Ohio clinic to meet some of the Michiganders who crossed over. And just a brief note, we met these folks before Ohio and Michigan paused use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccines. Let's take a listen.
We're from Rochester Hills, Michigan, and we drove here to get the J&J vaccine. I'm with my son Connor and my son Patrick.
I'm currently a junior at Oakland University this year.
And I'm currently a freshman at the University of Michigan.
Well, we were having difficulty finding what we needed in our local area, so we easily found an appointment here, and we were able to schedule within just a few days' time to come down and get the vaccine. Our biggest difficulty today was just getting through construction to get here because the exit we wanted was closed, so we had to take a little detour.
Yeah, and so, you know, I was looking specifically for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine because I have food allergies, so I wanted to get the Johnson & Johnson because I'd heard that it was, people react less to it if they have food allergies and that sort of thing.
I'm feeling good. I suppose the reason I came here specifically is because, like, I had the option to get it in Michigan, but this was a quicker choice, and I wanted to be vaccinated as soon as possible.
My name is Tasha. I'm one of the nurses. We work for an agency called ProLink, and they contracted with the health department to staff the vaccine clinic.
Do you get a lot of people coming from Michigan?
We have tons of people coming from Michigan. They are saying that they can't find appointments. I love it. Yeah, I love it that they are coming here to our county, especially with they're saying that Lucas County has a higher rate of COVID diagnoses. So I like that they come here to get the vaccine. So we screen everybody that comes through. We basically just ask them about their health conditions, if they're breastfeeding, if they're pregnant, if they've had a COVID diagnosis or test positive, any serious health conditions, that type of thing. We just want everybody to be safe before we give any injections.
And have you guys gotten your vaccine?
I have not.
Why?
I'm still deciding which one. I think it's just a personal preference. I've had a lot of family members. I think four or five of my family members came yesterday and I gave them the injection. I think it's a personal preference. It's not anything bad with any of the vaccines. I just kind of like, I'm more of a cautious person. I do a lot of research and I just want to make the right decision for myself. We've had a really good turnout each day. We're seeing anywhere from 3,000 to 5,000 people. So I'm amazed at how much of a turnout we had even today, even after that recall with the Johnson & Johnson, we still had a ton of people show up. Come on, more Michigan people.
What was the process here that you found today?
Very smooth. I mean, we literally walked right in, walked right up to a station to check in, walked right to an open table, got a shot in the arm. We've probably only been here maybe not even 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, it was really short, really easy.
Have you had other people that you know come here?
This particular location, no. But we have family in Ohio, and we also have friends that drove down from Michigan to get vaccinated as well, just at different locations.
I'd have to say, you know, with the less than stellar year we've had, I'm optimistic that we have the vaccine. I feel like some skepticism is valid, but like, I'm still choosing to take the vaccine.
Yeah.
Like, I still have my concerns, but it's something that's like still important to me and something that I think is the right thing to do.
Those were the voices of Patrick, Connor, and Amy Jordan from Rochester in Southeast Michigan, and nurse Tasha Davis from Northwest Ohio. At times like this, boundary lines between the states might have a little bit less meaning. Ohio's COVID case rates are once again climbing. And while Ohio and Michigan are both trying to tamp down the spread of COVID, vaccination is an important part of both states' game plans. Dr. Daniel Cadigan is the medical director for Toledo-Lucas County's Health Department. Dr. Cadigan, welcome to Stateside.
Hello, thank you for having me here.
Tell me, how's the vaccine supply in Lucas County this week?
We have adequate vaccine supply. We have both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines that we've been using through our clinics. As with the rest of the nation, we've had to hold back the Johnson & Johnson vaccine while the FDA looks at some issues with that vaccine. But we have had sufficient supply that we do have openings in our clinics and are not completely booked at capacity with the vaccine clinics that we're holding.
Is there a short answer for why it is that so many Michigan people were able to get appointments more easily in Toledo than here in our state?
Yeah, I'm not certain the entire answer. I know initially when the vaccine first was supplied, with certainly the counties close to the Lucas County border, we did have people that registered when we put notifications out on our health department website that we had openings available. We tried to do that when we had scheduled clinics and found out that we had enough supply that there were openings available, and we did not restrict that based on residents. Our health commissioner has certainly taken the attitude that although this is an Ohio supply of vaccine based on how it's distributed from the state to the various counties, the federal government to the state, that you know we have to look at this from a regional perspective. And we have a large number of individuals from Michigan that work in Northwest Ohio, and likewise a number of individuals from Northwest Ohio that hold down jobs and have family and or live in across the border in Michigan. Although this is considered a statewide supply of vaccine, our commissioner has definitely laid out that we are not going to turn people away based upon county or state residents. The important thing is getting shots into arms and getting people vaccinated to slow the spread of COVID-19. And the best way we can do that is by vaccinating as many people as possible within the region.
Well, it certainly speaks to the long ties between folks in both states. And I know there are plenty of Michiganders that really appreciate having had the opportunity. Do you have a number for how many Michiganders crossed over to get a dose?
I don't have an exact number. I will know that in some of the clinics I participated in myself, particularly when we vaccinated the teacher population, the school population here in Ohio, at our governor's behest early on to speed up the school reopening. On our Saturday clinic on that day, we had 4,500 people scheduled through a single clinic to vaccinate related to the schools. And we realized that there were a number of doses that we would not be using. And when that went out on the health department website, I was there helping out that afternoon. And I would estimate that, 25% of those extra doses, extra appointments we had available, it was people from Michigan, certainly as far up as Ann Arbor, not just simply in Temperance or Lambertville or just across the border.
Sure. Have there been points at which the supply of vaccine at clinics has been such that out-of-staters had to be turned away? I did hear anecdotal stories of some folks meeting with that at retailers that were administering the shots.
Right. Yeah. And I believe the retail supply comes to the federal government. So it's distributed differently than the health department supply that comes from the state. We don't have control over that. We don't always get all the data from that. So I'd had difficulty giving you numbers on that. I just will say from the Lucas County Health Department's perspective, early on, and when there was very limited supply and we were trying to vaccinate the highest risk groups, then certainly if somebody had pre-registered and did not meet the criteria, those people would likely have been contacted and told that they didn't qualify. That wasn't strictly on the basis of state only. I mean, that was on the basis of age within the state of Ohio as well. You know, somebody might register that was under 65 when we were vaccinating 65 and older, and we had a limited supply of vaccine. But I think there was less of that than people would have anticipated.
Right. As you mentioned, the FDA has now recommended that providers stop administering the Johnson & Johnson vaccine on a temporary basis. What outcome do you think that will have on vaccination plans for the Lucas County area?
It's going to be a very limited effect on our vaccination right now. We just announced today from the health department that we will be opening up vaccine clinics to walk-ins starting later this week, and certainly next week, some of those will be open strictly on walk-in basis only. And it's because the supply we have at this point is exceeding the demand we have for scheduled appointments. We want to make it convenient for people certainly to get in and get vaccinated when the goal is just to vaccinate as many as possible. The Johnson & Johnson was not a huge part of our supply. I think retail with the store-based pharmacies, certainly it was a one-dose vaccine. It was easier to handle. It was a larger part of their supply. But we've been meeting the majority of the need through the health department, particularly being a regional site from the state. And we can meet that with the Moderna vaccine and the Pfizer vaccine because the J&J was certainly a smaller portion of what we used. And certainly the hope is that as they review it and look at the data regarding blood clots that was seen, and we can refine more, you know, who the people are that may be more at risk of side effects, we can hopefully get that vaccine back out and rolling like they've done with AstraZeneca in Europe and still make it convenient for people.
Right. I was looking up some of the infection rates between Ohio and Michigan today, and Ohio's not in as bad a shape as Michigan right now, but it's not terribly far behind. Tell us more about the approach in Ohio regarding COVID health recommendations currently. What are there any restrictions that the county is under or the state has said?
Yeah, the county follows the lead from ODH and the state of Ohio through the governor. We have, you know, the governor's announced that we will be opening things up more. Certainly restaurant capacity increased. The plan was for sporting events to be able to open, particularly outdoors, with about 30% capacity. And I know the Toledo Mudhens fans are patiently waiting for that to start up. I don't believe with the drop in some of the restrictions in Michigan, from what I've seen, that we're a whole lot different at this point in time. There is still a masking mandate in effect, at least for another month or so. And what happens from there with some recent legislative changes in Ohio is going to be a wait and see. But I believe we're very similar right now to what Michigan has in effect.
Yeah, at this point, things are pretty much open, despite the fact that the governor has asked people to voluntarily stay home, to voluntarily, skip high school sports and to choose to have takeout instead of eating in restaurants. It remains to be seen the degree to which the public is following that. It doesn't seem like it's being terribly widely observed so far. Do you feel that there are any problems with discrepancies between Ohio's rules and Michigan's rules in terms of public health guidance?
I don't believe there's a lot of discrepancy. I know just recently, there was advice in Ohio to limit travel to Michigan because of their increasing numbers. Your increasing numbers there. But, as we see today with Lucas County now being, the highest daily rate in the state of Ohio, and certainly Hancock County just further down I-75, having one of the highest rates in the state, we're not too far off some of the Michigan levels in Northwest Ohio at this point. And even if we look at vaccination numbers, I know the Governor Whitmer had requested more vaccine for Michigan from the federal government, looking at those numbers, vaccination rates in a lot of the counties in Michigan are not a whole lot lower, somewhat lower, maybe 6-7% lower than in Ohio. But I think the big thing that's been driving a change certainly are variants. And you know, I think, again, we're starting to see more of that region effect right now. You know, the worst areas in Ohio tend to be Northwest Ohio. We're close to Michigan. But in Michigan's defense as well, we're also both, you know, Michigan as a state is very close to Ontario, which you see in some of the highest rates in Canada. So it's you know, trade has always come along the I-75 corridor out of Ontario and through Michigan into Ohio, then certainly variants of COVID travel the same sort of way.
I mean, do you think it's even possible to trace at this point? I mean, community spread is high in Michigan. Do you think it's even possible to say in a chicken and egg way who had the higher rate first and where it comes from? It feels up here as though things, you know, our hotspots developed a little ahead of the curve.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, certainly the national data shows several states and several regions that have certainly had more hotspots and more outbreaks. I think we're kind of blending into more of a regional effect with that right now. And even if you look at it in terms of, you know, variant numbers, you go further north to Ontario and the UK variant is reported to make up to about 70% of new cases. You know, in Lucas County, we're still reporting, you know, 11 or 12 cases of the UK variant. But given the numbers and the rise up to about 300 cases per day as of the day, you know, I would suspect there has to be a lot more UK variant, and a lot of those numbers vary depending on how often the genomic testing of the variants or of the virus is being done to determine it. So we get a skewed perspective on that, unfortunately. You know, I think the big picture is, you know, COVID's reared its ugly head again. We're seeing another increase in cases. We're seeing an increase in hospitalizations. And obviously when things change, we look for a reason as to why that happens. We either look and say, well, nobody's following the recommendations and nobody's wearing masks and everybody are getting together in large groups, or something else that's changed. You know, it's an issue, has the fire changed or is somebody throwing more fuel on the fire? And I think at this point, the makeup of the fire itself has changed somewhat with some of these more infectious variants that are spreading.
What would you like Michigan and Ohio residents to know in this moment about COVID?
Personally, I know we're all tired. I mean, I'm a primary care physician. I have two teenage children who want to be out and doing everything they were always doing. Everybody wants this to end. We want our normal back. People are tired of masking. They're tired of not being with friends and family members to the same degree they were. And the biggest thing I've told people is that it's going to take time. We have to try to be as patient as possible. And well, in some areas we've been able to let up on some of the restrictions we had, you know, getting together with somewhat larger groups of people, not strictly with immediate family, particularly people that are vaccinated. But I'd like people to still stick with masking, you know, trying to limit large groups, particularly so we can get things back to normal as soon as possible. I always liken it to this to a forest fire situation. And we get complacent because, you know, there may have been a number of fires and the fires are put out or brought down to simmering embers. And then you think, okay, good, everything's done. Wildfire season's over. But, you know, as California residents can tell you, if it's dry and there's high winds and it's hot outside, you know, certainly it's not the time to say just because the fires went out, let's all go back in the woods and have big campfires and bonfires and keep our fingers crossed and nothing happens again. You know, we still have to have an air of caution, and so that we don't get a raging bonfire with COVID going and put us back to square one.
Dr. Daniel Cadigan is medical director for the Toledo Lucas County Health Department. Dr. Cadigan, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Take care.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Stay safe this weekend. Thank you so much for listening.